This is Fall In, the Problem Gambling Podcast for military service members and veterans. My name is Dave. I'm a compulsive gambler and a veteran of the United States Army. And joining me tonight, straight off All In, the Addicted Gamblers Podcast, first and foremost is Brian. How are you, Brian?
I'm great, Dave. Thanks again for doing this.
Oh, thank you. And of course, last but most certainly not least, a man who's got his fingers in more avenues of recovery than I can possibly think of, Jeff. How are you, Jeff?
Hey, Dave. Great to see you. And I'm so glad you're doing this.
Thanks, Jeff. So one of the things we want to do with this podcast, one of the focus areas that we want to do is to have service members and veterans tell our stories with regards to, you know, being in problem gambling, searching for help, getting help, and then being in recovery. So I figured, well, since I'm kind of the one talking through the podcast, why don't we do my story first? So that's what I'm going to do.
And
here we go. So I am Dave. I'm a compulsive gambler, and I stopped gambling this time around January 6th of 2020. My tale is actually kind of a tale of two go-rounds, serious go-rounds with addiction, but I had the setup for addiction long before I ever got into the military or I was an adult. When I kind of think it makes sense to go back and kind of talk about what brought me to where I was. And a lot of it started when I was a kid. My mom divorced when we were very young. My brothers and I were very young. And not too many years after, remarried to a guy who we didn't really know who he was. We couldn't quite figure him out. He moved us from New Jersey to Pennsylvania, bought a farm, and then all of a sudden began what I call a number of years of what I call a terrorist state. So we were abused a lot. We were put to work immediately. I was about 6 or 7 years old and was immediately put to work as a farmhand. Every day when we got home from school, we would have to work till after dark. And if we got out of line at first, it was kind of, you know, a sneaker on the butt or a belt. And then eventually it became the sneaker and the belt with welts. And then eventually it became a hand upside the head. And then eventually it just became, you know, fear. I lived most of my childhood in fear. I can remember specific things, and I'm not going to get into too much detail, but I can remember he used to sit on a couch and, you know, if you ever had to go in to ask him for something, it was always with your eyes pointed downward. And if you were too soft, you got yelled at for not speaking for yourself. And if you were too loud, you got yelled at for being too loud. So there was never, you never knew what right was. I ended up really questioning a lot of things that I did throughout my life because of being treated that way. I second guessed a lot, pretty much most of my adult life, I've second guessed things that I've done. Couple that with physical abuse. My mother, who God love her, she wasn't there. She basically shut down because of all this that was happening to us. So we were kind of on our own, my brothers and I, and then eventually my sister when she was born. So we spent most of our youth years growing up like this. And at the same time, he was a horrible, horrible alcoholic. A terrible binging alcoholic. And it was so bad that I can remember I was at a school event with some kids and they were bringing me home, dropped me off in front of my house because I never let these guys into my house to meet my family. And I'm walking in the house and I open up the door into the kitchen and there's my stepfather urinating on our stove because he couldn't find the bathroom. So, you know, we learned to compartmentalize. At least I did. I learned to compartmentalize. I didn't talk about it. I didn't want people knowing who I was because I was a horrible, horrible kid who had this horrible, horrible family. At least that's, as I look back, that's kind of what was going on in my life. So a few years later, probably into my early teens, my stepfather decided to move yet again. This had been probably 8 or 10 times during that time, decided they were going to move again. Well, my older brother and I decided we wanted to finish school where we were. So my older brother moved in with a teacher that we had in elementary school. And I moved in with a person that I looked up to almost as a father figure. And I don't want to say exactly who he is. All I want to say is I had a great deal of respect for this man and thought that based on our interactions over the years that he would be a perfect fit for what I wanted. So I did move in with him and his wife, and they had foster children, which worked out even better, I thought, at the time. Well, it turned out that wasn't a whole lot better than what I stepped away from, because the gentleman turned out to have a sexual fetish that he wanted to play out on me. And his wife turned out to be, short of the abuse, not a whole lot better than my stepfather was. So, you know, again, I kind of out of the frying pan into the fire, and I certainly wasn't going back to where I came from. So I basically dealt with that situation until finally my best friend from high school offered for me to move in with him. I told him, without telling him everything that was going on, because God knows I wasn't going to talk about that, told him what was going on, and he finally offered for me to move in with him. So in the middle of the night, I grabbed all my stuff. I threw it in his car. I took my car, and we filled his car and my car, and I basically followed him out to his place. So, you know, and this was probably the middle of my teen years, I want to say sophomore or junior year in high school. So then I finally got to finish my high school years with this, with kind of a somewhat normal life, I guess. You know, his parents were fantastic. They took me in like one of their own. They treated me good. Got a job at a pizza place. But I can tell you that by now, a lot of what would carry me into adulthood was already built in terms of the way I did things. So, you know, I dated in high school, but I didn't really, when it got to a point where it was getting too intimate, I cut it off. You know, I interacted with people. I was social, but I never was, you know, I was great being the class clown. So I could be on a stage in front of 150, 200, 300 people, and it didn't bother me in the least little bit. But you put me in a room with three people that want to have a genuine conversation, and I wasn't there. I was done. Because at this point, I just didn't want to give of myself. My job was to hide. My job was to not let you know who I am. So fast forward a few years, in my early 20s, and I decide for the first time to join the Army. So I did. And I ended up in New York City for a few years. It was pretty good years. I dated, but it didn't really last. That stint in the Army, I got through unscathed. Everything went well. Between that and my second stint in the Army, I ended up getting married, my first marriage, and then having my two kids. That marriage was a very, very controlling marriage from the standpoint of my ex. So go ahead, Brian.
Dave, I just wanted to know, the part where you joined the Army, mm-hmm. what was behind the decision in joining the Army when you were in your early 20s? Because it wasn't right after high school, correct?
No, it was not.
What goes into that decision?
I wasn't really finding, honestly, it's just because I wasn't really finding a whole lot of work where I was, and I wasn't really interested. And I just decided to explore it and see what was available. I walked into a recruiter's office, and I was convinced at that point. So, oh, yeah, it was pretty basic. It wasn't a whole lot to it.
Hey, Dave, I have a question. At that point, did you ever get therapy as a result of, you know, the issues that you were obviously dealing with?
I never considered it, and nobody ever brought it up, Jeff. It never came up as an option for me. And I honestly didn't even think about it as an option for myself. I just thought I was somebody who was a little bit off and just had to deal with it. You know, had somebody pointed it out to me, had it been brought to my attention by maybe a school counselor or something like that when I was in high school, maybe I would have engaged in it. But thinking of it myself, no, I was already embarrassed enough to be living my life, let alone telling people that I'm seeing a therapist.
And did it cause any kind of issues that were, you know, obvious? In other words, behavioral issues, issues with substances, anything of that nature?
Not at that time that I can remember, other than the fact that I do remember that when I drank, boy, did I drink. It was to excess. Now, it wasn't every single day. I didn't fall into full-blown alcoholism, but I can tell you that I probably was moving in that direction. So, yeah, I guess looking back, yeah, there, had I not originally gone into the Army when I did, I probably would have gone down that path. So, yeah.
And my last question, Dave, and I know it doesn't matter, but I'm just curious about your relationships. That friend in high school who took you in, are you still friends today?
Oh, absolutely.
That's great.
He is my best friend, and every single New Year's Eve, we go over and spend New Year's Eve with him and his family.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, we're still friends to this day.
That's cool.
So fast forward kind of in between my stints with the Army, I did get married. I did have two kids. And again, like I said, my first wife was very controlling. The world, in my opinion, was about her at that time. So if I told her I was sick, it wasn't, oh no, I hope you get better. It was, oh no, now you're going to make me sick. So, and things like that. And there was, so it was a lot of arguments. It was a lot of not wanting to deal with that. You know, and then we had two kids, and then I decided to get that, because again, I wasn't seeing a whole lot of success in the job market. I thought, you know what, why don't I look at going back into the Army? So I did. I looked it up. I got myself back in. I could not get back into the job that I was doing the first time around. So I got into a second job, a different job that was fell under the veterinary corps, ultimately fell under the medical corps. So got myself into that. Got, you know, we had an assignment in Illinois and Wisconsin, and then eventually came down on a set of orders to Korea. The set of orders to Korea came down early in 2001. Actually, it was mid-2001 that it came down. And as we got closer and closer, and it was actually my ex that talked me into reenlisting to take this assignment. I wanted to get out and get a job right where we were because I had some good offers. But she wanted me to stay in, so I said, okay, I'll do the year in Korea and we'll see how it goes. Well, as we got closer to it, I got more and more arguments about the fact that I was going away for a year and leaving her there by herself, to which my response always was, well, you're the one who talked me into reenlisting for it in the first place. You know, at least I got to be honest, at least that's how I remember it. You know, the conversations may have been different, but all I remember is this is my childhood all over again. I don't like this. So that's how I remember it. So fast forward, it is November 2001. We are a month and a half separated from 9/11. There's fear everywhere. Bush is talking about his axis of evil. And of course, I'm getting on a plane, leaving my two young children, and at the time, my wife, to go to Korea for a year. It was stressful. It was very stressful for me. I did not like it at all. Flew over there. It was a 16-hour flight. Got into Osan Air Base. Then we were shuttled to Yongsan, which is in Seoul. It was a couple-hour trip. And put up in a very nice hotel. Honestly, on the military bases, they have some really nice hotels there. But I had no desire to be there. I did not want to be in that country. I mean, all the gates had, you know, were concreted up with 50 cals. We're all wearing, you know, we're all wearing protective gear because it's just post 9/11. And of course, at that time, North Korea was part of the quote unquote axis of evil. So we were on constant alert. So I got on there. I'm stressed out. I'm tired. I'm hungry. I had just eaten in this very, very nice hotel, and I'm walking around, and lo and behold, what do I hear but some sounds and dings and bells coming from a room somewhere in the hotel on the main lobby floor. So I walk up and I look in and I'm like, wow, this is like a casino in here. It was a slot room. There was a room full of slots that looked like a small version of a casino. I had been to casinos in Atlantic City when I was in my 20s. And at that time I could take $100 with me, spend 50 of it and drive home, you know, either with a few more bucks or without that 50, but at least I had gas money still. So I thought, okay, I mean, this looks fun. I got some time to kill. I'm not ready to sleep yet. I'm too wound up. I'm stressed out. Let me sit down and relax for a little bit. So I took a little bit of money out of the ATM and I went in there and I sat down, and within an hour made the biggest mistake any gambler can make. I hit. Now we're not talking, you know, and my career kind of hit, but it was a significant amount of money for me for that time, you know, for just a little bit that I had put in, it was a pretty good payback. And I can sit here and I'm telling you, as I'm sitting here talking to you right now, I can remember the feeling of all of the sudden, all of that anguish, all of that stress, all of that fear, all of that crap that I was going through just in that moment went away. It just went away. You know, I felt fantastic. So I stayed there for a little bit longer. I probably played out almost the amount of money I made, although I did leave with some money in my pocket. And I know that honestly was the start of me beginning to move towards that invisible line that they talk about in compulsive gambling. I know it. I felt it. I still feel it as I'm talking about it right now. As the year went on in Korea, It got, you know, I got to the base that I was going to, which was at the southern end of the peninsula. And sure enough, there was a game room there too. There was one on every base. So I started playing, you know, in the evenings, maybe on the Saturday for an hour or so. And within, it had to be not even a month, I was playing every weekend. I was playing almost every night that I could go, I would go.
And Dave, when you say a game room, is it just simply slot machines? Are there other forms of gambling in there, or are there other actual just games in there as well?
No, it was all slots.
Just 100% slots in the room. Okay.
Yep. There was either there were traditional one arm bandit slots, and there were the digitals. It was just filled with those. So.
And did you ever go with other service members or yourself, or what was it like?
No, I started off going by myself, and that's kind of the way it stayed. I would go to the club there. It was attached to the service members club, so the bar was right next to it. So I'd go to the bar with everybody. But whenever I went in that room, it would always be by myself. That was my free space at first, you know, my space to just unwind and not deal with the pressures of anything. It eventually became the place I had to go to. And it, and like I said, it did not take long. Before long, I was calling to my then wife saying, "Hey, I need a few extra bucks because we're going out on the town to do a, you know, a tour trip this weekend or something." And then I'd start saying, "Hey, one of my soldiers needs help. I need to hook him up, you know." And when that started to wear out, I started borrowing from my subordinates, from my soldiers. And anybody who knows and has been in the military knows that if you're a non-commissioned officer, which I was, that's not a very good move. As a non-commissioned officer, you're supposed to operate on a little, you know, higher level in terms of the way you keep yourself and the way you conduct yourself. And I was degrading quickly. Went home on my mid-tour leave 6 months in, came back from my mid-tour leave and jumped right back into it in terms of the gambling. Now I was leaving in the middle of my day, saying that I had a meeting or something to do. And being the non-commissioned officer in charge, being the head enlisted guy for my unit, I could do that. And nobody really questioned me. You know, now here's the dumb part of all this. While all this is going on, I developed a training program that ended up getting used in the peninsula, at least parts of it, throughout my entire unit. You know, I was doing well. I was taking care of my soldiers. I ended up getting the expert field medical badge, which is one of the hardest things to achieve in the Army. I prepared myself for it and got that while all this was going on. So it was kind of like leading this double life, you know?
Did anybody know that you were gambling, Dave? I mean, were you known as, oh, there's Dave. He loves to, you know, sit at the slot machines and gamble on his breaks, or
no?
I was completely hidden.
No, what they knew was as the year went on, oh no, here comes Jaeger. He's going to borrow money from me, my soldiers.
And they didn't know why?
Obviously, I can't hear you, Jeff.
I'm sorry. They didn't know why they were borrowing the money?
If they did, they didn't say it. If they did, they didn't tell me.
I mean, I just find it, and it's kind of unusual, isn't it? I mean, the first thing that I guess would enter my mind is, well, this guy's either doing drugs or you know, something's going on, right?
I would guess that they probably did say something to somebody, but I know it wasn't to me. You know, and part of the reason is I was their boss. I was their NCOIC. I was the guy in charge. So, again, if they did say something, it wasn't directly to me. And, you know, when it finally came to a head was we kept, in our clinic, we kept a petty cash fund in the clinic. And I ended up breaking into that petty cash fund. I did it multiple times throughout the course of the year and always put it back. Somehow I was always able to put it back. Well, I finally had a night where I broke into it and I wasn't able to put it back. So an investigation started, and one of the first people that they came to was me. And that's how I knew somebody was paying attention. So one of the first people they came to was me. And I immediately confessed to what I had done. You know, I felt that guilt, that shame. I knew that it was the wrong thing to do. And told them that. And immediately I was actually, my first sergeant at the time came to me and said, "I would like to put you on a suicide watch because I'm really worried about you." Now I insisted that she didn't, and they ended up not doing that, but it was nearing the end of my tour there, and I actually got disciplined for it. I ended up losing rank for it. which is a shame because I was headed back to a really good position and I lost that position because of it. But the weird part about it was at the same time I got an evaluation and a lot of the categories I was being evaluated on, I got some pretty good scores on it. So again, it was this double life I was leading. I was doing all these good things as a non-commissioned officer, but at the same time, destroying myself, diving into a gambling addiction.
Hey, Dave, when you said you went for your mid-tour leave
mm-hmm.
a few minutes ago, did you gamble during that? I assume you went home and you saw your family?
I did not gamble. Not during that mid-tour leave, no.
It never occurred to you to try to go anywhere? And
I was too focused on my kids at that time.
And you had been away for how long at that point?
I got to stay home for 30 days. I had been in country for 6 months and got to spend 30 days at home. So I spent that time with my children. And of course, trying to connect with then, you know, my first spouse, trying to just have a normal life with her. So no,
and it wasn't going through your mind at all in the back of it. You weren't thinking about it, having urges or anything to go play.
Part of me couldn't wait to get back so I could get back to it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. But as far as urges while I was in, you know, stateside, no, didn't have urges. So I got back from Korea and I got stationed in South Carolina at that point. And my first wife wanted the kids to finish school where they were. So I drove down by myself to find a place in South Carolina. I had a few months to do it. And actually on the way driving to South Carolina, I stopped in Kentucky and gambled most of the cash I had away on me. So I picked up on it right away again.
And what's in Kentucky?
Was there, there a casino? There's a casino there.
That yeah. casino you went to? Okay.
Yeah. In South Carolina, in the time that I was there, I got into scratch-off tickets because there were no casinos really close to me. And good Lord, every day at lunch when I was working, I'd go out and spend $100 or more on scratch-off tickets because that's all the time I had to do during my lunch break. On long weekends, and before she got there, I used to drive. There was one casino in South Carolina at the time. It was 6 hours away on the western end of the state. I would drive 6 hours to spend an hour there to run out of money to drive 6 hours back. So by that point, I was pretty entrenched in my gambling.
And did scratch-offs do it for you? I mean, I was a slot player after a while for a long time, and I remember a couple times getting scratch-offs just because, like, oh, I'll grab some, but it never satisfied in the same way. Did you find that it was satisfying in the same way?
I will tell you a story coming up in a little bit, but the answer is it didn't quite satisfy the same way as slots did, but it was pretty close.
Okay.
And again, I'll tell you a story about that coming up shortly about how obsessive it got for me. Just to put a kind of a cap on this end of it, I mean, long story short, my ex ended up separating with me because of the gambling addiction and because of the troubles and the debts that I had gotten myself into, because I just kept borrowing on personal loans at that point. And I was also pulling away from her. I wasn't engaging with my children like I normally did. I wasn't engaging with her at all. I just had no interest. I'd lost interest. So eventually we separated. She stayed in South Carolina. I moved on to Texas. And then my world fell apart at that point. There was a lot that went on when I was down at Texas, when I was stationed there. But the long story short is that's where my first suicide attempt happened. I stole again from a unit. And this time, not only did I lose rank, I got kicked out of the Army for it. It got really bad. I can tell you at one point, this was on a Navy base. At one point, I was stationed on a Navy base, and after my suicide attempt, I went in to sit down with a mental health professional from the Navy, and she was sitting talking to me, and I was telling her about what I was doing, and everything that I was telling her was gambling-related. Everything was gambling-related, and I can sit here, and I can remember that conversation. I don't remember the exact words that were said. All I remember is the completely and utterly baffled look on this woman's face trying to figure out what to do with me. She had no clue. She had no idea. She dealt with alcoholics. She dealt with drug addicts. She dealt with suicidal people before. She dealt with people with depression and anxiety. But I don't think she ever faced somebody like me with the size of the gambling problem that I'd gotten myself into at that point. So at that point, and again, because there was so much confusion within my unit, within the Army, with the Navy doctors, they decided to gracefully chapter me out of the Army with a good discharge. Even though I had stolen, even though I could have ended up in Leavenworth for what I did, even, you know, they put me out because they knew that underneath of it, there was a character, there was a person of good character. They knew that I was messing up and I was making a lot of mistakes, but they couldn't put two and two together and figure out exactly what to do. So I did get reduced in rank again. I got released from the Army mercifully with a decent discharge, which allowed me to get into the VA system. And then I was out on my own, separated, no job, you know, in a car that was about to fall apart on me, and had to drive from Texas, where I was at the time, back to Pennsylvania, which is where home is. Along the way, I stopped in Alabama, and of course, I gambled again, gambled away everything I had. So then I stopped at my aunt's place in Georgia and borrowed some money from my cousin, limped my car up to my ex's place, where she fixed the car for me. And then got back home to Pennsylvania. And I got to be honest, as rough as this all sounds, me listening to it now, it was only the beginning. It was only the beginning. Between 2005, August 2005, when I got out of the Army, and June of 2007, when I first went into treatment, I went through five jobs. I had three suicide attempts. I moved three times. And I'm going to tell you the story, Brian, that I was talking about earlier. Whenever I couldn't get to casinos, and there were plenty right near me, whenever I couldn't get to one, though, I would do scratch-off lottery. And at the time, I was renting a room in somebody's house. When I went out to move out of that room, I had a single bed. When I moved that bed, there had to be 100 pounds of scratched-off lottery tickets under that bed that I had just shoved under there. It had to be 100. I can't even tell you the amount of money worth of tickets that were sitting under that bed when I moved it. I even shocked myself, and I was the one putting them under there. I closed my curtains every single day. I wanted nobody to see me. I talked to no one. If I went to work, it was to make my money. At one point, I went down, got a pay. I had money in my pocket, so I went to a casino and spent 36 hours in the casino, not knowing I was spending 36 hours in the casino, up, down, up, down, up, down, until eventually I had no money left, drove myself back outside into the parking lot of a hospital, took an entire bottle of pills, ended up in the hospital, realized the next morning that my paycheck was in the mailbox, so I AMA'd, or against medical advice, took myself out of the hospital, drove to my mailbox, took that paycheck out, cashed it, and went back to the casino. My head spinning, still coming down from all the stuff they gave me, you know, charcoal slushy and all, took myself right back to the casino. And it's when I left the casino that day that I knew I needed help, that I knew I was not beating this no matter what I did. I was so desperate at that point. I can remember sitting at the casino running out of money. And I've heard people say this before, but I remember this feeling of, good God, mercifully, just let it be over. Take my money and let this be over, you know? And then I would go up a little bit and I'd be like, oh man, shit. Now I got to wait for this to go. And I would not leave until it was gone. I would not leave until it was gone. I've told this story a few times, and it's something, what I just told you now is something that sticks with me, but there's another one. And this is where the addiction is just baffles me to no end. I can remember driving towards a casino one day. And as I'm driving towards the casino, I'm yelling at myself, stop, stop, turn around, stop. There's tears in my eyes. My face is bright red. I'm punching the roof of my car as I'm driving, yelling and screaming at the top of my lungs. And I'm still driving toward that casino. My foot is still on the pedal going towards the damn place. I get up into the parking garage. I get out of it. I open the door. I hear all the bells and whistles. I smell everything. And all of the sudden, everything that I felt driving down there just went away. It went away. I can imagine, God love them and God respect them and God help them, what a heroin addict goes through when they first shoot up. I can imagine what that feels like, because to me, that's what that felt like. All of that stress, all of that conflict went away. It's also why I call this the Jekyll and Hyde addiction. You know, because Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sitting there in the back of your head, tapping you on the shoulder going, nope, nope, gas pedal's going down. You're not turning around. You're not doing it. You know?
Hey, Dave, can I ask you?
Yeah.
because you had said that you probably should have ended up in Leavenworth, but you were mercifully discharged from the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question's two: how close did you come, and was that, were you actively worried about that?
No, I could have cared less. That would have been a relief for me at that point. Did I think about it? Yeah, it popped into my head. But all I did is when I sat down across from the investigator, when they asked me a question, I told them the truth. At that point, it was one of those points in my life where I just had given up. You know, I'd given up because I didn't know how to defeat this. I didn't know how to beat it. So I almost wanted them to put me in jail just so I could stop, but they didn't. They let me go. So,
and then my other question was, did you know of anybody else who had gone through what you had gone through at that point, or anybody else who had done something similar to yourself that did end up getting in trouble worse than what you went through?
I can't think of anybody offhand from that experience. I know looking back now that there were people that I ran into in those facilities, in the casinos in Korea and specifically, that were, if I were to guess, I would say were going through something similar to what I was going through. Now that I understand the glazed over look, now that I understand that look of defeat, now that I understand what it means not to be able to get up and walk away, I can look back and see guys that were in that position. I can remember it. But to say someone specific that went through something similar, I can't think of any offhand.
And just to be clear, these rooms were on base.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, they were on pretty much every single military installation had, there were some had two of them, but everyone had a slot room on it.
And to be clear, these are just overseas bases.
Correct.
Because I know there's a law that prohibits that in the U.S., but obviously overseas, as we know, that there are many bases that have slot machines. I guess my question to you is one that sometimes I ask myself, and that is, why gambling? I mean, why? Sometimes I wonder, why was that my addiction of choice? Right? Why didn't I get addicted to alcohol and drugs? And the reason why I'm asking you specifically is because, especially with service members, alcohol use disorder is just so prevalent. I mean, that really is an epidemic. So why gambling and not alcohol?
I can tell you, if I look back, here's what I think. I grew up with an alcoholic father. I grew up with an alcoholic stepfather. I grew up with several alcoholic uncles, and I saw how bad it can get with alcoholism. And that, I think that was a scared straight thing for me. So I was convinced I would never, ever, ever become an alcoholic. And I would pay attention. When I was drinking, I would pay attention. And I did binge sometimes. And when I did, I would stay away from it for a while, just because I had a fear that I was going to end up like they were. So I honestly think, if I were to think back, I think the fear of looking like some of what I saw in alcoholism kept me from doing that. I think if I hadn't found gambling as an outlet, I think there's a very, very, very good chance I would have turned to alcohol. So that's a good question. So when I finally, by the way, this, now we're looking at 2006, I was divorced. I hadn't seen my kids in over 6 months. I hadn't spoken to my kids in over 6 months. I was destitute. I'd already had a couple of, I was living in my mother's basement. I already had a couple of suicide attempts behind me. I was taking and giving up jobs just as quickly as can be. And I had pretty much given up. I looked around for different, you know, treatment centers where I could possibly figure out how, you know, I was going to the VA and seeing counselors there, and they were teaching me about belief circles. They weren't talking to me about gambling. At the time in 2000,
belief circle?
Yeah, there's just how to look at your beliefs and challenge your beliefs, basically.
Okay.
It's good stuff. Don't get me wrong, but it's
not what you were looking for.
It was not helpful. And at the time I was basically just telling them what they wanted to hear anyway.
And you were how old at this point?
I was, oh Lord, probably about 40.
About 40. Okay.
Yeah. So, and in talking to one counselor at the VA that I was going to at the time, they had said, "Hey, had you ever heard of the gambling treatment program?" I'm like, "No, what's that?" So they gave me some information on it about a gambling treatment program. It was at the time in Brecksville, Ohio, which is just south of Cleveland. So I actually made the call, and the answer to the call came back to me from Dr. Lori Rugel, who's no longer with the VA, but at the time was. And, you know, she and Dr. Heather Chapman were running the program at the time, and they immediately got me into the program. They said, we have a bed. You're going to come out here on June 18th. So on June 17th, I got in my car. I started driving out in the middle of the night. And of course, I stopped along the way as much as I could, and I gambled the entire way out to Cleveland. So when I got to Cleveland, I had $0 in my pocket. I had $0 in my pocket, just about no gas in my car. I'm 6'1", and at the time, I weighed 162 pounds. I looked horrible. I mean, horrible. I had no clothes to speak of, you know, and I got out there and I had just decided to give up, you know. And what I mean by give up is I decided I couldn't figure it out anymore. I was just going to let go and have somebody else teach me how to get through this. And I got to tell you, boy, am I glad I did, because that was the start of my journey. I was there. I actually ended up being in Cleveland. I got there in 2007 and I didn't leave until 2009, 2 years later. And when I left there, at least I thought I was doing really, really well. I hadn't gambled in quite some time, you know, in a couple of years. I had a job, you know, things were going really well for me. The thing of it is, I had been going to meetings pretty consistently while I was there, and I started to feel so good, I stopped going to meetings. You know, I stopped going to meetings. I stopped engaging in counseling. I stopped a lot of the stuff that was working for me because I thought I was doing fine, you know, and it
like
seemed
cured.
Like,
it worked.
Yeah, I was cured. I was cured. So I'm like, I don't need that. Right. I don't need that stuff. So I eventually ended up back in Pennsylvania, and it's kind of weird. Oh, yeah, here's a story for you. Before I went out to Cleveland, I was working for a franchise for a major fast food restaurant as a manager, in the general manager's program, was working overnight. So I had the job of, at the end of the night, putting the bank deposit together, running it down to the bank window and dropping it off before I would go home. So on a Friday and a Saturday night, didn't I go ahead and take those deposits down to the casino with me and gamble them away? The second night, because I knew they weren't going to check the bank account. They weren't going to check the bags till Monday morning. So I had the entire weekend to win it back, to get that back, quote unquote, back in the bag and try to get it into the bank. Yeah. And sure enough.
In other words, you were just borrowing the money, right, Dave?
Pretty much. Yeah. In my mind, yeah, I was. Exactly. In my mind, I was.
Because we don't embezzle. We don't steal. We just borrow.
Yeah. That's what we do. Yeah. The second night of doing it, it had to be 3-4 o'clock in the morning. I had a little bit of money left in that bag, and I was so destitute at that point. I just got in my car and started driving home. And on my way home, I thought, I have three choices that I can make right now. Choice number one, I can take the little bit of money that I have left, buy some food and gas, and run as far as I possibly can. Choice number two, I can spend the rest of this money on some beer and some food and then end up offing myself and be done with it, which seemed like a very appealing choice at the time. Or choice number three, I can go turn myself in and do the right thing. I made the decision at that point to go turn myself in. So this was no longer military. This was civilian now. So I turned myself in, and they ended up putting me on what's called an ARD program, which was, because of my military service background and because it was my first offense, it was a program where if I went to probation, if I paid back restitution, then eventually everything that I would have been charged with would be expunged. My record would be clean. And sure enough, I screwed that up too, because while I was in Cleveland, I stopped making payments. I stopped contacting my probation officer and came back to Pennsylvania for a weekend, and they caught me on a warrant because I hadn't been checking in. I had no idea this warrant was out on me. So I ended up in jail for a weekend. So that actually ended up becoming, that went on my record. That ended up becoming what I thought, they had told me at the time it was a misdemeanor charge. Turns out it's a felony charge that sits on my record to this day. So, you know, the stealing caught up with me finally. It finally got to me.
What, you know, just for people listening, Because I don't know, what is jail like when you, like you said, you were in for a weekend? What is that process? How were you feeling while you were in jail? Because that's heavy, what you were just talking about. I mean,
it was pure panic for me.
Uh-huh.
It was pure panic. They put me into this environment that, you know, I didn't expect. I'd never been through anything like this in my life. I smoked at the time, so they took my cigarettes away. So I was going through withdrawal. They gave me, at the time I was on an antidepressant, so they gave me a version of the antidepressant that actually I think was 10 times worse. I can remember walking down from a counselor's office because I got to go make a phone call at a counselor's office, and I'm walking back towards the cell area, block or whatever they call it, where I was, and literally I'm bawling like a baby the entire walk back there. Laying on a concrete bed, curled up on a blanket with a little tin toilet sitting there that I was afraid to use. It was a horrible, disgusting experience that I never, ever want to go through again in my life. And it was only for 4 days. It was 4 days.
Was it enough to make you stop gambling?
No.
Brian, I remember, us having a conversation about, this, I guess a woman that you had met in GA that,
yes,
that said the gambling is what caused her, or she claimed created enough fear in her so she didn't gamble afterwards. And I never could understand that concept because
the one who went to prison?
Yeah, the one that went to prison. I guess, and again, you know, and everybody has obviously their own experiences, and whatever impacts one person may not impact another. But I know for me, I can't imagine anything except treatment causing me to stop gambling.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what happened to her afterwards. I mean, I moved away, but I mean, she went to prison for a lengthy period of time. And I know I'm not demeaning the jail for 4 days, but she went to prison for, you know, a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, that could possibly change you. And inside, I think she was going to meetings. So,
yeah, well, that would be awesome. Yeah.
Fast forward. I'm back in Pennsylvania. I've reestablished my life. By this time, I've made contact with my kids, and I've reestablished contact with my kids. And now I meet the woman who is now my wife. And I say meet her. I didn't meet her. I actually dated her in high school. And we hadn't spoken for almost 30 years. And I just arbitrarily looked her up on Facebook with no intentions. And sure enough, we hit it off. And then we got together in 2011, and we got married in 2014. I had some good years in there, but I got to be honest, slowly but surely, the addiction was coming back and I didn't even know it was. Had no idea it was, but it came back in a very different form. As opposed to running to a casino or doing scratch-off tickets, this time I was borrowing money. I was gambling with borrowing money. So I would borrow personal loans and I'd get a credit card, and then I'd get a personal loan to pay the credit card, and then I'd have to get another personal loan to pay those personal loans because I never used household money to pay these things off. And I was convinced that somehow miraculously I was going to be able to pay these things off and get myself out of this before anybody knew what was going on. Meanwhile, I'm lying to my wife. I'm manipulating my wife. I'm using the fact that she trusts me to do what I wanted to do. Which as I look back is just, even saying it now, I get a pit in my stomach because she's one of the most, you know, unpretentious, caring people you would ever want to meet in your life. And she is the person, I can't imagine myself being married to anybody else. And the fact that I did this to her, I can't even believe. This went on over several years, taking credit cards out, loans out. And then eventually I got caught up in this online philanthropy where people claim to want to give you money online, over Twitter primarily. And I got myself wrapped up into it and ended up getting taken for over $6,000.
Excuse me, Dave, when was this?
This was last year.
And I remember, and I think you and I discussed this, yeah. I remember seeing some of your tweets about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I should have reached out to you. I really should have. But I just remember thinking that that was kind of strange. I mean, clearly it wasn't gambling, but the fact that you were tweeting about these kind of unusual schemes to get money should have raised a red flag. It caused me to think about it, but I honestly just felt, well, I think Dave knows what he's doing, so who knows?
Yeah, and honestly, I snowed a lot of people that way, Jeff. The truth is, that was kind of a form of gambling because I was taking a risk putting out personal information to people that I didn't know. You know, there are some genuine philanthropic people out there who are willing to help them, but they're few and far between. And you have to be, you know, you can't just arbitrarily give information to people. But I was so desperate at this point to catch up on all these loans that I'd been back on that I was willing to try anything, you know. And it finally all caught up with me at the end of last year, going into the beginning of this year, where I took I went out and I got myself a bunch of these, a bunch of weight loss pills, and I found ones that were the highest speed ones you could find. It's the one that could possibly do the most damage I could get. And took a bunch of them. It was actually on January 3rd of this year. I took a whole bunch of them, you know, hoping, not intending to hurt myself, because like you said, Brian, I kind of suck at it, but, you know, kind of half hoping that it would happen anyway. And then spent that weekend sick on my couch, saying that I was sick, trying to decide whether I wanted to live my life and get into recovery or whether it was time for my life to be over. Because at that point, those were the only two choices I had in my mind.
You know, Dave, excuse me, we often, you know, hear about people that do similar things. It may appear like a suicide attempt, but it's very often not enough to complete the job.
Yeah.
Clearly not enough. And it's usually looked at as a sign of, I need help. You know, I need attention. Somebody needs to help me. Not, I want to end my life. Is that something that you were feeling?
The ultimate act was almost exactly that. It was more of a cry for help than anything. But I can tell you honestly, as I went through that period, as I went through December and into January of last year, I had some very real and very genuine, more so than I've ever had in my life, thoughts of ending it. You know, a couple times I was pretty close. Thankfully, I didn't. Thankfully, I did not follow through with those thoughts. I just think, you know, that's something, it's so selfish. What a selfish move to take your own life, you know, because I already knew at that point that I had a grandchild on the way. So what a selfish move that would have been. Long story short, and here's kind of the I say it's the funny part, but it's not really the funny part because it had a huge impact on me, is as I was sitting on that couch, I can hear Morgan Freeman's voice in my head from Shawshank Redemption going, get busy living or get busy dying. I kid you not, those words in his voice went through my head. And I almost chuckled when I heard it. And I thought, okay, this is my time to make a decision. So I made a decision. And that morning, January 6th of this year, I took myself to a VA, checked myself into a psych ward, and my journey began. And I can tell you that the beginning of that journey was a very, very, very rocky road. And Jeff, you know this because you saw it. I reached out to you that day. I called you that day. It was an incredibly, incredibly rocky road. But then I also reached out to Dr. Heather Chapman at the Gambling Treatment Center, which is now in Cleveland. And she immediately got back to me and got me in at the beginning of February to go through that program again, the gambling treatment program. So between the groups that I'm doing, my GA meetings, the groups I'm doing with you, Jeff, and then the gambling treatment program, I've been able to get what I consider a more of a real foundation under my feet than I ever did the first time around. And I thought I did pretty well the first time around. But I look back now and I look at the things that I'm doing now and the things that we're doing now, and it's so different from what I did before. You know, now I go to my wife and I tell her what I think is the dumbest little thing. I just tell her because I want to be very, very honest with her, because, you know, I'm still not 100% sure that we're going to be together for the rest of our lives. I damn well hope so, but I don't know that because I let me tell you something. I yanked the bottom out from under her so bad. I did so much damage in that one day when I came clean, that we will never go back to where we were before. It's never going to happen. I'm hoping we can be even better as we get stronger and I get more further into recovery. But I also know that that was a big cut. I mean, that was a big blade and I cut deep with that one. So, you know, that was been one of the hardest things for me. And then the other part of it is I now have a grandchild and I want that little girl to never know me as anything but her grandfather. I don't want her to know me as the grandfather who gambles. I don't want her to know me as the grandfather who lied again. I don't want her to know me as the grandfather who went away. I just want her to know me as her grandfather. That's it. So, you know, that motivates me. The fact that I feel as good as I do and as real as I do right now motivates me. The fact that I'm able to sit here and do this right now and share my story, you know, and share other people's stories and bring other people into the fold so that we can all recover together. That's what keeps me going. That's what drives me right now. So my world is very, very different. I feel more grounded than I've ever felt. I feel more confident and secure in myself than I've ever felt. And, you know, my goal at this point is to just keep moving forward, you know, a day at a time. It sounds so cliche, but man, is it true. Just getting up every day and just getting through that day and living that day. So,
you know, Dave, it's almost surreal for me because I think we discussed this when Keith White was with us on the podcast. But you and I met because I was doing a conference for our Delaware Council on gambling among service members and veterans. And Keith White, who's the executive director of National, had suggested I reach out to you. And that started our friendship. And you ended up speaking at that conference. And that was in March of 2018. And just as you are today, you speak so well and so confidently and talk about your past experiences as someone that really has, you know, their shit together. And you were like that in March of 2018. And when you did reach out to me in January of this year to tell me what was going on, and, you know, this is from me, somebody that knows about this addiction firsthand, you shocked the shit out of me because you would be the last person that I would have thought would go through something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it really taught me, in a sense, that we're not free from this addiction. And no matter how good we may appear that we're doing, it's something that is always in us. And if we're not careful, and if we're not vigilant, and if we're not proactive, it can rear its ugly head and cause more destruction than it caused the first time around.
I completely agree. And the reality is, that's why I call it the Jekyll and Hyde addiction, because Jeff, even if at the worst of it, if you and I had met in last October, November, December of last year, even if we had met, had dinner together and sat down together, you probably would not have known what I was going through. I got that good at hiding it. I got that good at masking it. I got that good at compartmentalizing it. If there's one thing I want to suck at, that's it. I want to be horrible at masking how I really feel. You know, it's different because it's so weird. Like just today, I snuck a little bit of a piece of pie at breakfast this morning, you know, while my wife was doing something. And the first thing I said when she walks out is, "Hey, I took some pie, just so you know." You know, I feel like Jim Carrey now in Liar, Liar. I just got to say it. I just got to spit it out now. But it feels good. It feels good. It's so different, you know. But yeah, and this is one of the reasons that if I put myself in the shoes of my family, that I can understand where they are, because the people that were closest to me never knew, never had a clue, you know, they never had a clue. And I can tell you anything, but I can also mask it well. So the only thing I can do at this point is live my recovery. And if I live my recovery, it's going to show on its own, you know.
Dave, what made you, Jeff referenced that Keith White had referred you to Jeff. What brought on that relationship between you and Keith? I assume it had something to do with your military service and your story. How did that come about?
That was an interesting story. A couple years before I met Jeff, I was trying to gather information for another book. You know, I wrote my book be happy with crappy and all that. And I was trying to gather information for another book, and I was looking for people I could interview, and his name popped up. So I sent him a copy of my book along with information on how to contact me. And I said, I'd love to be able to talk to you as I kind of understand and gather information and learn more for this other book I'm writing. So sure enough, he calls me. He calls me on the phone, and he and I talked. God, that first night, it had to be for a good hour or more that he and I talked on the phone. And while we were talking, he was talking to me about advocacy. He was telling me about Advocacy Day and a lot of the things there. And he invited me down to speak, you know, as they were trying to, you know, get leverage for the, you know, the bill that they were trying to get passed to get care for service members dealing with gambling problems, or at least to get the screening in place to start screening for gambling problems in the military. So he invited me down to talk at in a Senate informational briefing down at the Capitol. Went down there, and I got to speak before some of, I think it was Senator Warren's staff that was there, and I got to speak for them. And then from there, we started to do Advocacy Day, and Keith and I just kind of hit it off. I like Keith a lot. You know, I hope that Keith and I are friends for a long time, because I love Keith's passion. I just love the way he just takes the bull by the horns, having never been a problem gambler in his life. He listens to what we say, and he takes it into account, and he uses that to try to advocate for us. So we really, really hit it off. So that's kind of how we, you know, got together, if you will. That's kind of how we connected. And then, of course, Jeff, knowing Keith already, reached out to him, and that's how we connected. So,
Dave, here we are wrapping up episode 2 of your podcast. What kind of response are you looking for here early on? What would make you the happiest of the responses you could get? Are you looking for people to come on and tell their story? Are you looking for people who can help those who are in recovery? I mean, I'm sure you're looking for it all, but what would you like to see happen next here on your podcast?
I'm going to give you a prime example. Hi, Dave. My name is so-and-so. I'm a veteran of whatever service, or I'm an active duty service member in whatever service. I struggle with problem gambling. I didn't know where to go. I heard this. I want to tell my story.
And do you think, though, that any active duty, not necessarily veterans, but active duty, do you think they would, not fearful, but be a little apprehensive about coming on here while they are still active duty and telling their story? Do you think they would have any reason to feel that way?
Maybe, yes. I don't know what the repercussions would be if they did that. I can tell you this, I will listen to their story offline.
Yeah.
Just to give them a chance to tell their story.
Yeah, I know you would.
Yeah, it doesn't matter to me whether it's on here or not. Now, it's great that we're able to share stories, but you know what? Keith said something in our last episode, in the first episode, that he's absolutely right about. You know, recovery comes first, second, third, and fourth. So doing what we're doing right now, I feel comfortable doing this. I feel no hesitation telling my story and putting it out there. But I'm never going to ask anybody to put themselves in a position where they feel like they're going to be compromised. So if they don't feel comfortable doing it in this forum, then get a hold of one of us. You know, get a hold of me. I'll talk to you on the phone. You know, I'll try to help you find GA meetings in your area if you're not familiar with it. You know, I know Jeff, you know, and his groups, that he will open his arms up and say, here, come to this group. Here are the dates and times we're doing it, you know? So it's not just about being on here. Although, again, telling the stories here is what helps us get the word out.
Right.
You know, Brian, I was contacted probably at least a year and a half ago by somebody in the military. I believe he was based somewhere in Colorado. And, you know, told me about his gambling problem. And he was almost as concerned about his gambling problem as he was about the repercussions that he felt he was going to have to face if the problem was discovered, which is such a shame. I mean, I'm no expert on what happens, you know, in the military with people that disclose an addiction to alcohol or to other substances. But it's my understanding that there is a pretty well-oiled process to get service members help and not to punish them. And Dave, you probably know more than I do. But I do not believe that that exists with gambling. And that is just a tragedy because, you know, again, this person was just really stressed out what to do. In fact, you know, I did call a couple of people. I don't want to say who, but
sure.
And people that are intimately involved with, you know, issues in the military. And there was no solution that I could give this guy.
But do you think that's a microcosm of the rest of society? Is that gambling addiction isn't looked upon as the same as substance abuse?
Yes, it certainly is. But I don't think for most people it would have the kind of consequences as it would if you were in active duty.
Sure.
I mean, dishonorable discharge, losing whatever rights you have, right, Dave, for your military pension, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it really, talk about the, you know, the walk of shame. I mean, it's just treated like you are an absolute criminal and not somebody that has a mental health disorder.
Yeah. And I'll say, you know, again, they were merciful to me in terms of letting me out with the discharge that I got, but had there been something in place to begin to understand me as a problem gambler, and if the same protocols or similar protocols were in place for somebody who has a problem in gambling that there are for alcohol and for drugs, I might have been able to finish my career. I mean, I don't know that I would have. I can't guarantee that, but I at least would have had a chance. You know, these guys with alcohol and drugs, they get the chance to finish their career because the focus is on getting them healthy. The focus on a gambler is to find out, you know, what the heck's going on with them, and then let's find a way to either get them out or stop. Just stop. I mean, it's you know, there's no treatment. It's either you stop doing it or we're going to get rid of you, or we're going to punish you, or we're going to reduce you in rank, or whatever it happens to be, you know?
I will say that there's clearly a difference once you're out of the military and you're a veteran. You know, Dave and I were both at a conference. When was it? Probably a year ago or so.
Hey, two years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Justice for Vets, which is an amazing organization for veterans. And Dave and I were involved in doing a presentation on gambling addiction. And of course, you know, the VA with Dr. Chapman's group and so on. But these are for veterans. They've already served, you know. I think it's very different if you are in active duty and are dealing with that issue. I remember, Dave, you know, when you were first giving your story and I heard it for the first time, just remember one of the things that really stuck in my mind was they didn't know what to do with me. And that's such a shame.
Yeah. That sticks with me, Jeff. I still think about that to this day. And that's what I you know, I've said this probably a dozen or two dozen times already. If they had any inkling what to do with me, like I said, I would have had a chance to have a career. And for me, it's not about me anymore. I'm in recovery. I'm doing the things I want to do right now in my recovery. For me, it's about the next guy and trying to put things in place for the next guy, the next me that's out there that's struggling, that really, really wants a career in the military, but struggling with problem gambling. And, you know, what do you do? What do you do? I would have been afraid, and I was afraid to say anything to anybody because I didn't even really know what I was dealing with at first, you know? So to know, have somebody out there who knows what to look for, just educate units, educate non-commissioned officers and officers on how to look for the signs and symptoms of a problem gambler. So you can at least sit down and ask the question, hey, is there something we need to talk about? I'm noticing this, this, and this. What's going on? You know, I'm noticing you're going out late at night. Is there something we need? Is there a gambling issue? Are you concerned? Are you spending more than you think? You know, whatever it is, whatever the questions are, I don't know. I'm not the expert in that area. What I know is sit down, look them in the face and say, I'm noticing something's going on. What's happening? You know, so.
Well, Dave, you did offer that if anybody would like to tell their story to come on, and I just wanted to give the email address in case anybody wants to do that. And then obviously, if it's anybody active duty or anybody who does not want to come on but would like to speak with Dave, I will definitely get that to you. But the email for the podcast currently is leestreetpod@gmail.com. That's LEESTREETPOD@gmail.com. And I will make sure that you get in touch with Dave through that email address. And also, as you know, I used to say it a lot more, but I haven't in a while, which is that anything you send me is confidential. I'm the one who receives the emails, and it doesn't go out to anybody else unless you ask it to go out to somebody else. So I wanted to give that out there. And also, you can find Jeff on Twitter at JPWDEL1955. And I'm now on Twitter, which is at BrianLoves2.
Woo-hoo.
And Dave, are you on Twitter?
I most certainly am. You can find me at Dave Y Grampy.
So there you go. If you do want to reach out just to get in touch with one of us or Dave, you can do that. Yeah. So thank you very much, Dave, for offering that to everybody. And I hope people will respond. And I know we did it on the other podcast, but we did have a veteran on here to tell his story with you the last time we did that, Zach. And it was a very powerful story. And, you know, it went well, and Zach is a great guy, and I'm glad we did that. And, you know, I hope more to come with this. So again, Dave, thanks for doing this, because I think it's an important subject.
Well, thank you guys for sitting in with me, because it's, you know, you guys having my back like this is what helps to make it work. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to be able to do it. I appreciate if there's people out there that are concerned, if they do have questions, please reach out. Even if it's not to us, reach out to somebody, because there's help out there. I remember feeling so alone, like nobody could ever understand me. You know what? There are people out there that will understand you. Just say something. Say something. So, all right. Well, I guess we're going to wrap this thing at this point. We're near the end here. So on behalf of Brian, who I want to thank very much, and also on behalf of Jeff, who I want to thank very much, I want to thank you for your time. And in typical fashion, we started with Fall In. We're going to end with Dismissed.
This podcast is owned by Lee Street Media, LLC. Music provided by T Vance. Remember, this is a podcast. The views expressed on the podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests. If you need help for a gambling addiction, please seek professional help.